Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Ganga Mayi ki jai, Jamuna Mayi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveda Vrinda ki jai. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 9. The Dynasty of Amshuman, Text 30. Soyam Brahmarshi Varyaste. Soyam Brahmarshi Varyaste. Rajarshi Pravavar, Rajarshi Pravaradvibho. Rajarshi Pravaradvibho. Katam Arhasi Dharmagya. Katam Arhati Dharmagya. Vadam Pitur Ivatmajaha. Soyam Brahmarshi Varyaste. Rajasi Pravaradvibho. Katam Arhati Dharmagya. Vadam Pitur Ivatmajaha. Soyam Brahmarshi Varyaste. Rajasi Pravaradvibho. Katam arhati dharma gya. Vadam pitur ivatma jaha. Saha, he the Brahmana, I am this, Brahma Rishi Varyaha, not only a Brahmana, but the best of great sages or Brahma Rishis. Te, also from you. Raja Rishi Pravarat, who are the best of all saintly kings or Rajarshis. Vibho, O Master of the State, Katam, how, Arhati, he deserves, Dharmagya, O you who are quite aware of religious principles, Vadam, killing, Pitu, from the Father, Iva, like, Atmajaha, the Son. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. My Lord, you are completely aware of the religious principles. As a son never deserves to be killed by his father, here is a Brahmana who should be protected by the king and never killed. How does he deserve to be killed by a Rajarshi like you? Purport. The word Rajarshi refers to a king who behaves like a rishi or sage. Such a king is also called Naradeva, because he is considered a representative of the Supreme Lord. Because his duty is to rule the kingdom to maintain Brahminical culture, he never desires to kill a Brahmana. Generally, a Brahmana, woman, child, old man, or cow is never regarded as punishable. Thus, the wife of the Brahmana requested the king to refrain from the sinful act. Om Agana Timurandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Nama Vanshakalpatiruvyascha Kripa Sindhubi Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, let me begin by saying this is my first time to this beautiful temple. I was here many years ago, but at that time the temple was in Evanston. So it's wonderful to see this enthusiasm of the Vaishnavas and the glorious worship going on here. And thank you very much for allowing me to come and to speak a few words to you. And also I had one question. Just before we get to the topic, that I think I heard this morning we're supposed to break fast at 8:47. Was that correct? Right. So, how are we going to do that? Oh, okay. I can't read the clock, so somehow or other that clock is unreadable by me. Oh, okay, much better. Okay. So here we're continuing with the story of this very unfortunate king, Saudasa. And I thought we could begin by just kind of an overview of the Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of how we got to this point. I think that question came up a little bit yesterday. So the Bhagavatam, its primary function is to glorify the pastimes and activities and philosophy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the activities and the presentation, the philosophy given by his great Vaishnavas, great devotees of the Lord. So the first two cantos are like an overview or an introduction to the work. Many extraordinary points are made in the first two cantos. And then from the third canto, we find that part of the day of Brahma is described in the various cantos of the Bhagavatam. From the third to the seventh canto is the Manu, the first Manu, Svayambhuva Manu, and his descendants and their many activities, extraordinary activities. And then from the eighth canto, very quickly we cover seven manus in one canto. And here we are in the ninth canto, and we're studying the manu Vaivasvata Manu, who is our present manu. And so in that sense, at least from the third canto to the tenth canto, it's chronological. And we find that there'll be some verses where so many personalities are mentioned, and so-and-so is the son of so-and-so, and he had this wife, and they had those children. And it's gone through very quickly, and then they'll find some extraordinary personality in that lineage, and then there'll be so many chapters about that personality. For instance, when we come to Devahuti and her son Kapila, there's seven chapters devoted to Kapila's philosophy and his teachings to his mother Devahuti in the third canto. And similarly, there's so many chapters about Prahlad Maharaj in the seventh canto. So in other words, we have a chronology, but it's focused on the Supreme Lord, his devotees, and his teachings. So here we have this very unusual canto, the ninth canto, with many stories that are quite exotic and unusual, this being one of them, the story of Shaudasa and how he's affected by this Rajarshi, not the Rajarshi, but the Rakshasa. The Rakshasa mentality has overcome his Rajarshi's mentality. And here he's doing this horrendous activity of wanting to devour this innocent Brahmana. So there's so many points we can learn. One was mentioned yesterday about tolerance. Another one we can learn from these pastimes is how lust devastates our attempt for spiritual life. And these various lessons are leading up to our conclusion. The conclusion of every one of us should be that this material world is not a place for us to be, that we want to transfer ourselves to Krishna's world. And Krishna's world will be fully described in the very next canto, the 10th canto. So in that sense, this can be seen as a preparation, that there's cursing and counter-cursing, revenge, men becoming women, becoming men, and how we're not this body anyway, so whatever body you're in, it's secondary to the idea that we're spiritual beings and we want to flourish spiritually. So these are important points to see the scope of the Bhagavatam, the direction of the Bhagavatam, focus of the Bhagavatam, and to relish and rejoice in all those things. So here, one, from getting down to this verse, one important point, several important points we can learn from this. And one of them being that there is on one side destiny, and the other side there's free will. And this is true for every one of us. So we can say on the one hand that Saudasa, he was this king who killed this demoniac person but spared his brother. And as a result, his brother somehow became his cook and served human flesh to Vasishta. And as a result of that, Vasishta became angry at Saudasa and cursed him. And now he's experiencing the results of that curse by wanting to be so cruel to this innocent Brahmana. So you could say, okay, that's destiny. You know, he's under the spell of this curse. He has no freedom from that spell. And that, you could say, is supported by some shlokas. And Bhagavad Gita says, Krishna says that all living entities are overcome by desire and hate. He also says that the bewildered spirit soul under the influence of these modes of nature is forced to act helplessly, overcome by the modes. So in that sense, it seems like we're all victims of destiny. All of us have been placed in this body. We didn't have a choice who our parents were, where we were born. You know, the formative years that we were controlled by our guardians, our parents, or whoever was our guardian. So in that sense, that was given to us. We know from our philosophy that Prabhupada has given that that's the result of our previous activities and desires that were put in a particular circumstance. But also Prabhupada presents that we have free will. Krishna presents that we have free will. The idea being that each of us is a soul, part and parcel of Krishna. And just as if you see the vast ocean, if you want to understand the qualities of the ocean, you can take one drop. And if you analyze that drop, you'll get an idea of the contents of the ocean. One drop is salty, it has minerals, it has whatever it has. So similarly, the ocean has salt, it has so many ingredients. So one of the qualities of Krishna, that is also one of our qualities, is this independence. It's called svarat in Sanskrit. Krishna is completely independent, and we have minute independence as his part and parcels. However, in lower species of life, animals and plants and fish and birds, they're unable to exercise this independence. It is only in the human form that Krishna has given us this ability, and which makes the human form very special. It was in this previous verse, verse 28, Prabhupada in the purport quotes Narottam Das Thakur's song, Hari Hari Vipale Janama Goyanu, which at one point, what's 8:24? The breakfast? Oh, okay. Hare Krishna. Excuse me. There was a pastime when Prabhupada was at John Lennon's estate in England. He would spend time in his room every day, and there was a harmonium there, and he would sing. And our god sister Yamuna Devi was there also. She was cooking for him and serving him in different ways at that time. And she would stay outside the door listening and just crying, overcome with emotion to hear Prabhupada sing these beautiful songs by the Acharyas. And she was very quiet, but somehow when Prabhupada stopped singing at one point, he called her name, Yamuna. And I don't know, she doesn't know how he knew that she was there, but she answered him and he said, come. And so she entered the room and they played together. She would play the kartals, and she also recorded. Some of the recordings we have today were because that she had this little tape cassette recorder, and she recorded him singing at John Lennon's estate. So in between songs, Prabhupada asked her at one point, what is your favorite song? And I think she may have said Shikshastakam. And then she asked Prabhupada, what is your favorite song? And he said this very song here, Hari Hari Vipale Janamagoyana Bashila Narottam Das Thakur. And if you ever hear him sing it, he sings it with such heartfelt feeling. It's very moving. But the translation is, the body of a human being is extremely valuable because in this body, one can understand the instructions of Krishna and attain the ultimate destination of the living entity. The living entity is within the material world to fulfill the mission of going back home, back to Godhead. So this means, this is an indication to us that as human beings, we have now this privilege of actually executing our independence, our free will. So even if we're born into unfortunate circumstances, still, we have this independence. So in one sense you could say Sodasa is a victim of this curse. What can he do? He's bound to act in this way. But in another sense you can say no. And it would be correct that because he's human, and especially because he comes from a high parentage, he has now the benefit of instruction from the wife of the Brahmin. She's giving very good advice. So he's responsible, and for acting improperly, as he will act, he's culpable for that, as we all are. Later on, it's described in the 11th canto, Madhvacharya makes the point that once a human being is over the age of 14, that person is responsible for his or her acts. So that means that each of us is responsible, and if we act irresponsibly, there'll be some negative repercussions, some karma for that. And conversely, if we act responsibly, following the instructions of Guru and Sadhu and Shastra, we'll be benefited. We'll take advantage of this human form of life and be able to go back home, back to Godhead. So it's a very important point that's relevant to each and every one of us. We can learn from this Sodasa that, you know, he made terrible mistakes. First of all, allowing a Rakshasa to be his cook. And the cook's mentality enters the food, which is one of the reasons that we are enjoined not to eat food prepared by a non-devotee. It may be vegetarian food, maybe organic food, it may be very tasty food, but if it's cooked by a non-devotee, there's some danger there, because that on a subtle level, that affects the preparation that he makes. In India, Prabhupada would very often have programs in life members' homes, and they would cook their vegetarian food, and they were not devotees, they were pious people. And the standard was that we would bring the small deities, it's called the Utsava Vigraha, the traveling deities from the temple, Radha Krishna. And the pujaris would also come, they would establish an altar in the home, whichever home we went to. There would be a full arti, and we would offer whatever it was they cooked, we would offer. And in that way, Prabhupada felt it was all right for us to honor that. But otherwise, if we just go here or there and take without that purification of making it into prasadam, then there's some kind of risk there because of the mentality of the people involved. So there's a note of caution for us. And then we know Vasishta realized that what he was being served was unfit for human consumption, and then this curse descended on the head of Sodasa. So also we get a hint here that of the Vedic culture that Prabhupada is portraying in so many places in his book. Raja means king and Rishi means a sage, but when you combine them and you have Raja Rishi, what you have is a king who has wisdom, who's sagacious, one could say. And that sagacious king, one of his qualities is that he listens to the Brahmins. He learns from the Brahmins, and he behaves according to the instructions of the Brahmins. And if he fails in that, he's unqualified as a king. We have other examples in our Srimad Bhagavatam of kings who were unqualified. Janmashtami is coming up, so one of the pastimes around Janmashtami is when Vasudev was taking his newly wedded wife, Devaki, after their wedding. They were on a chariot driving to Vasudev's home. And as is the custom, Devaki's brother Kamsa was driving that chariot. And while they were going, there was this prophecy from the sky that the eighth child of Devaki will kill you, addressed to Kamsa. So Kamsa, being completely unqualified as a king, decided immediately on the spot to kill his sister. Such a heinous mentality. So just as here we have the wife of the Brahmin pleading with Sodasa, trying to introduce some wisdom into his consciousness, so similarly at that point, Vasudev tried to introduce some wisdom into Kamsa's consciousness, explaining to him that birth, if you're born, it means you're going to die. There is no avoiding it. Forever, whoever is born in this world will die. That is inevitable. And it's not to be, especially for a Kshatriya. A Kshatriya should not be so attached. If a Kshatriya is called to go out to fight, he doesn't think, oh my gosh, I might die in the battlefield, I can't fight. A Kshatriya is heroic and chivalrous. So Acharya should be fearless in the face of death. That is one of the qualifications. And yet Kamsa had such a low mentality that just hearing that he was going to be killed in the future by the eighth son, that means at least 8 years in the future, minimum. He was ready to kill not only a woman, but his sister on the spot. So what an unfortunate mentality. And Vasudeva, being very diplomatic, pleaded with him in different ways, explaining that he gave wonderful analogies, just as you see the moon in the sky and it's fixed, but if you look at a reflection of the moon, it's all wavering according to the movement of the water. So similarly, as spiritual beings, each one of us is fixed or eternal or cognizant or full of joy. And yet in this world, covered by a body, then we feel distress, we feel misery, we feel fear of death. But we're not to take this reflection, this flickering reflection, seriously. We're supposed to see the fixed nature of the soul and the glory of the soul as a spiritual entity. But this wisdom had no effect on Kamsa. And so finally Vasudeva said that, simply spare my wife's life and I shall deliver you whatever children may come. And since Kamsa knew that he was a man, Vasudeva was a man of his word, he did that. He spared Devaki's life. So that's another example of a king unable to hear the wisdom from his well-wisher, just as we're seeing here. There was another example, that there was this king Anga many years ago, and his wife, unfortunately, was the daughter of death personified. Her name was Sunita. So they had a son after, it wasn't easy, but they finally had a son. They named him Vena. And unfortunately, this Vena took the qualities of his mother. It's said that very often the daughter will take the qualities of the father and the son will take the qualities of the mother. So it happened in this case. And Vena, being the son of the daughter of death personified, was extraordinarily cruel and heartless. He would unnecessarily kill animals in the forest. And even as a child, he would be playing with his friends and he would actually kill them. So his father was just horrified by this behavior, King Anga. And he tried to rectify his son in many ways, and he was unable. His son remained cruel. It was just part of his being, it seemed. So in great disappointment, King Anga gave up the kingdom. He left in the middle of the night. And the citizens were feeling very bereft of their king. They didn't know what to do. And they turned to the sages, and the sages decided that the kingdom needs a king. And so, consulting with Sunita, the queen, they decided that this king would be Vena, the son of King Anga. And they just prayed that he would rise to the occasion. And unfortunately, he failed to rise to the occasion. He was a despot. A tyrant, one could say. And he went so far as to tell the Brahmins in the kingdom that they should not do their oblations to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He tried to stop the fire sacrifices. So the sages were very upset, and they came to him, and as we see here, the wife of the Brahmin is talking to Sodasa. So these sages came to King Vena and tried to steer him back to the right path, explaining to him the duties of a king is to represent the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to allow the Brahmins to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to ensure that all the citizens in the kingdom are properly engaged as servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in different capacities. So unfortunately, King Vena was not only not receptive to their message, but he actually told them that they were like prostitutes and that they should be worshiping him, that all the demigods are said to be embodied in the king, so he was worthy of their worship and they should not worship Vishnu or Krishna. So the sages were just outraged by this, and they immediately decided to kill him. And simply by their powerful mantras, they were able to kill King Bhana. So in that sense, they were unable to change him by their words, and they had to take very forceful and unusual action. So this is part of our history that we find in the Bhagavatam. Ordinarily, the king, Prabhupada writes here, the duty of the king is to rule the kingdom to maintain brahminical culture. A Brahmin, woman, child, old man, or cow is never regarded as punishable. So this is part of our culture, that these five, the Brahmin, the woman, the child, the old man, and the cow, are meant to be protected. There was one lecture in which Prabhupada was talking about this, and he gave himself as an example. He said, just like I am an elderly person, and all of you are protecting me. In other words, we would provide for him his meals, try to make sure he was comfortable, arrange for his travel with the least inconvenience we could. So in that way, we extended ourselves to him. He was both a brahmana, as well as elderly, as well as, of course, our spiritual guide. And he functioned in all those capacities by giving us knowledge that was invaluable, that changed our lives, the knowledge and his personal example. So we remained indebted to him. Perhaps today is also the very auspicious disappearance day of Rupa Goswami and Gauridas Pandit. So we could say a few words about them and then perhaps have a discussion on some of these points. So Rupa Goswami is very famous in our line. We are all called Rupanugas as followers of Rupa Goswami. And he was, although he was born, he and his brothers were born in a Brahminical, very high-class Brahminical family. They became ministers under a Muslim ruler in Bengal, Nawab Hussein Shah, and they considered themselves outcast by the Brahminical society because they were taking orders or under the jurisdiction. They were employees of this Nawab Hussein Shah, and they're highly qualified ministers, quite experienced in diplomacy. They both knew several languages fluently, were very wealthy. And they became attracted to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. They actually changed their names under this Muslim ruler. They were called Dabir Khas and Shakir Malik. Dabir Khas was Rupa Goswami, and Shakir Malik was Sanatan Goswami, his older brother. And at one point, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to Ramakeli, a little town in Bengal, and met them. And at that time, they both decided they would give up their posts in this Nawab Hussein Shah's government and become followers of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Rupa Goswami did that immediately, and Prabhupada mentions how he divided his wealth. He was vastly wealthy. At that time they dealt in gold coins, and he had thousands and thousands of gold coins. So he divided half his wealth he gave to brahmanas and those who were engaged in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then with the remaining one quarter of it, he put aside for emergency. And with the last quarter, he gave to his family. So Prabhupada says this is exemplary for all of us, that we should follow this standard. And then he left. He immediately left. He put out a query to the devotees in Jagannath Puri about the itinerary of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he found that Lord Chaitanya was going to go to Vrindavan. So Rupa Goswami and his younger brother, Anupam, immediately left, and they managed to meet the Lord in Prayag, Allahabad. And there the Lord instructed Rupa Goswami for 10 days in a place called Dasasvamedha Ghat. And those instructions became what Prabhupada gave us as the nectar of devotion, the Nectar of Instruction, also very valuable books about how to do devotional service and about the higher stages of devotional service, the various rasas that Krishna has with his devotees. Perhaps we've all read these books and they're just very rich for us in understanding what we're doing and how to do it, what to emphasize. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked Rupa Goswami to go to Vrindavan and to establish the places of pilgrimage there, and also to write books about Krishna consciousness. And so he did that. He established the Radha Govindaji temple, Radha Damodar temple, yeah? Radha Govinda? Sorry? Radha Govinda temple. And his samadhi is in the Radha Damodar temple, yeah. Prabhupada used to sit in his kitchen and he would look out the window at the samadhi in Bhajan Kutir of Srila Rupa Goswami. That was a great source of inspiration for him. So he wrote many, many books besides these, the ones that Prabhupada has translated. He wrote the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. That was Sanatana Goswami. He wrote the Laghu Bhagavatamrita. Brihat Bhagavatamrita by Sanatana Goswami, his older brother, is a fascinating study of Vaishnavas and how this Gopa Kumar goes to different areas in the universe and beyond the universe. Brihat means big, so it's the great Bhagavatamrita, and then Laghu Bhagavatamrita by Rupa Goswami, his younger brother, explores different pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his devotees. Highly valuable literatures. He also wrote plays, many plays, Rupa Goswami, and he explained devotional service in minute detail and established Lord Chaitanya as the Supreme Personality of Godhead also. He gave us this verse that we chant, Namo Maha Varanaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namane Gaurita Maha. That came from Rupa Goswami. And many, many verses that Srila Prabhupada would quote, explaining devotional service, how it has to be free from karma and free from gyan, pure devotional service. Is unmotivated, free from these desires for personal gain. We know from the Nectar of Devotion how he delineated the qualities of Krishna, 64 qualities of Krishna, and he gave examples for each quality. And he explained how the jiva can have up to 50 of those qualities, and then beyond that, Lord Shiva has a few more qualities, and Vishnu and Narayan have a few more. And Krishna alone has all 64 qualities. There are four qualities that are unique to Krishna. Do we know what those are? The four qualities that are unique to Krishna as delineated by Rupa Goswami. And he's engaged. Yes, he's playing the flute. Incredible pastimes with his devotees. He's always surrounded by his loving devotees. The childhood pastimes, the beautiful pastimes as a child, and his extraordinary beauty, his beauty which is unexcelled even by the other incarnations, his other expansions. So in that way, it's a if we look at what Rupa Goswami has given us, it's an extraordinary body of literature. Just he was personally exemplary in every way, and his grasp of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings and his ability to give those teachings is beyond compare. He's glorified by Srinivasacharya, Nana Shastra Vichara Naika Nipuno Sadharma Samstapako. He glorifies Srinivasacharya, and his Goswami Astakam glorifies all six Goswamis, and Rupa Goswami is foremost among them. So a few words about Rupa Goswami. And then there's also the disappearance day of Goridas Pandit. There's a few words about him in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. We I can read if technology cooperates. So this is the Adi Lila, text 11, verse 26. Gauridas Pandit, the emblem of the most elevated devotional service and love of Godhead, had the greatest potency to receive and deliver such love. Maybe I'll read that once more. Gauridas Pandit, the emblem of the most elevated devotional service and love of Godhead, had the greatest potency to receive and deliver such love. Purport. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes in his Anubhasya, it is said that Gauridas Pandit was always patronized by King Krishnadas, the son of Harihoda. Gauridas Pandit lived in the village of Shaligram, which is situated a few miles from the railway station Mudagacha, and later he came to reside in Ambika Kalana. It is stated in the Goro Ganadash Deepika that formerly he was Subal, one of the cowherd boyfriends of Krishna and Balaram in Vrindavan. Gauridas Pandit was the younger brother of Suryadas Sarakela, and with the permission of his elder brother, he shifted his residence to the bank of the Ganges, living there in the town known as Ambika Kalana. And there's a list of his descendants and further explanation of the places where he resided. That was a little bit about Gauridas Pandit. There's so many great Vaishnavas that preceded us that we don't know too much about, unfortunately. Perhaps over time more will be unearthed and shared with us. So these are a few points related to this. Perhaps there's some discussion on this. Many valuable lessons in the verse and purport, Prabhu.
Thank you so much, Vishakha Mataji. I wanted to ask you that, as you mentioned in the class, the mistake of King Shodasha was terrible, just to allow it by, for whatever reason, to have this Rakshasa cooking, and what to speak of that at the to the service of his spiritual master, Vasishtha Muni, he allowed that to happen. I can imagine a situation like that, that you're serving your spiritual master and then allow him to be served meat. So no doubt a terrible mistake, and the result was terrible too. He became himself a Rakshasa. Now, you traveled with Srila Prabhupada for so many years, and you saw devotees that make different levels of mistakes, and how Srila Prabhupada dealt with that, if you can, you know, if you remember some of the situation or you experience some of the situations of, you know, Prabhupada dealing with very, you know, terrible mistakes sometimes disciples have committed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in relation to Prashadam, there was an incident in, there was a farm near Hyderabad in India. And from the very beginning, the very foundation of this farm, it was problematic for many reasons. And one of the problems Prabhupada visited there was that the devotees hired a cook who was supposed to be a Brahmin. It turned out that not only was he not a Brahmin, he was also not a cook. So they served guests at one point, cooked by this so-called Brahmin, so-called cook. And Prabhupada, as he was wont to do, as he very often would do, he requested to be served some of the prasadam that was given to the devotees and the guests. So when he tasted this prasadam, he became very upset, very upset. He said prasadam was not fit for human consumption. It was such poor quality. I don't know if it was the ingredients or the way it was cooked or both, that I can't say, but he was very disturbed that this substandard prasadam would be given to guests. And so he told very straightforwardly and quite emphatically that he of his displeasure with the leaders there. And then I thought it was very instructive that he gave example from his own life. He said that when he was in New York at 26 Second Avenue in the early days, he was cooking himself. At that time, in the beginning, none of the young men and women who were coming knew anything about cooking, or to speak of cooking vegetarian meals. And so Prabhupada himself would be in the kitchen cutting and spicing and preparing sabjis and dal and rice and chapatis for those young people. And being young people, they would eat quite a bit. Sometimes they could eat, one person could eat 15 chapatis at a meal. That was their only meal of the day, so they were, besides being young, they were hungry. And so he said every day I was cooking 15, 20 people, and on the for this love feast, he would cook for 200 people himself. And so he expected them to come to this standard, not to hire somebody so unqualified and so undevotional. And as a, I guess, a point of inspiration for them and guidance, he gave himself as an example with the prayer that they would follow his example and not think, oh, I'm a big manager, I can't lower myself to cooking or something like that. This kind of fallacious thinking is very detrimental to devotional service. Krishna appreciates all the service. We have the example of Lord Ram building the bridge and appreciating the spider or whatever, chipmunk, whatever it was that was flicking grains in, as equal to the huge boulders that Hanuman and the others are putting in. So Krishna does not need our service. What he needs is our love. And if we can give that to him, he appreciates that. And especially if we can give up our false prestige and think some service is not worthy of me, that the mentality is not pleasing to Krishna. Rather to give our full energy to serving in whatever way that's required. We still have a few minutes left.
Question about being under the control of material nature, one of the first points you were making. In regards with like a life of devotional service and how to engage according to our nature, but not necessarily limit ourselves to that also. If you have any experience of overcoming your nature, but like that, overcoming the nature that we have so we can do more service, but we're also told we're supposed to act within our nature as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a balance. That there's a service that may be required and the service that it's our propensity. So how to balance those things, something like that. So because we're in this particular body that we're in has some proclivity, and generally we become good at whatever that proclivity may be. We're stuck with this mind and this body, but every one of us has something we can do that will be pleasing to Krishna, that we also love to do. That's our propensity. And as I'm saying, that generally, if we follow our propensity, we become good in that activity, whether it's a mental activity or a physical activity. And so that expertise is pleasing to Krishna, and that should be encouraged. That's part of good management, is to see what propensity a person has and to engage that person, utilize that propensity fully, because it makes the individual happy. And yet also, in management, there are things that need to be done. And sometimes there isn't a person who has the propensity to do those things. And so in those cases, we're asked to do them, understanding this is necessary as part of our service, but not necessarily something that will go on long term. It's because it's needed. So both things have to be balanced. I don't think we should try to ignore our propensity or to subjugate it because of emergency. Rather, we can keep it in mind, this is what I would love to do for Krishna, and with that prayer, Krishna may give us that facility. And in the meantime, for the sake of Prabhupada's temples, for the sake of the preaching movement, we do what's required. So again, it's a balance between those. Did that work? Okay. Thank you so much for your attention. All glories to His divine grace. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.